Daniel chapter 5. And I couldn't resist entitling this message, The Writings on the Wall. The English language, like most other languages, has a number of interesting phrases, idioms, metaphors, sayings that we use to express ideas. Some of the ones that you know and probably take for granted are things like, don't count your chickens before they hatch, or a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, or let sleeping dogs lie, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, don't cry over spilt milk, and so we could go. And all of these sayings become part of everyday life. We know them, we know what they mean, we use them. What we don't know is that some of those phrases, some of those little idioms which are so useful to us, actually come from the Bible. Let me list some of them out to you. These come from the King James. By the skin of your teeth, it's from Scripture. A fly in the ointment, it's from the King James Bible. If you've ever accused someone of having sour grapes, it's from Scripture. This one surprised me. To fall flat on your face, it's from that's a scriptural metaphor. Nothing new under the sun, of course, comes from Ecclesiastes. All of these come from the venerable old King James Bible. And one such phrase is the phrase, the handwritings on the wall. When we use that little idiom, we usually mean that the end is coming for something or someone. Usually a destructive end, a dangerous end, some kind of catastrophe. And the person in question knows that this is about to happen. When we say the handwriting's on the wall, this thing is winding down, and the person in question understands the end is near. And this elegant little phrase comes from a stirring, even frightening account of a Babylonian king who met his end through arrogance, through pride. And this chapter, Daniel chapter 5, is not merely there to supply us with a useful idiom. It's to warn us about the dangers, again, of pride. Just like Daniel chapter 4 warned us about what happened when a king like Nebuchadnezzar exalted himself, so chapter 5 is really a mirror image. The only difference is it doesn't have a happy ending. The king in question did not humble himself. Now, pride is foolish and pride is dangerous, but there's a step beyond pride. Beyond pride, there's the act of defiance. You can become so intoxicated with your own success, with your own abilities, with your own pride, that you come to a place where you dare God to judge you. You dare Him to intervene in your life. You dare Him to step in. That's exactly what King Belshazzar did. And when he did, the handwriting was on the wall for his reign and for his life. As we study Daniel 5, we're going to learn what happens when someone who lives on borrowed time insults the one who lent him his life. We'll see what happens when the creditor finally comes to collect. And through it, we should be chastened about defying God or living as if our life is unlimited. Let's begin in Daniel chapter 5, verse 1, as we look at the arrogant feast. The arrogant feast. Daniel 5, verse 1. Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of the 1,000. The arrogant feast takes place on the very last night of the Babylonian Empire. We know that as we read the end of the chapter. This was the very last night that the Babylonian Empire existed. This is 23 years after the death of Nebuchadnezzar. And here, Belshazzar is on the throne. Who is this Belshazzar? Where does he come from? What's he about? For some time, critics of the book of Daniel, you might remember how many critics there were of Daniel, of it being true, criticized the book of Daniel because they said, there was no such man as Belshazzar. This was just some invention by some Hebrew author who had no idea who'd actually lived. Remember, they said Daniel was written just around 170 BC as a kind of a patriotic book to make the Jews feel really good about themselves. It really hadn't been written in the year 600 to 530 BC. And they said, here's one of the examples. Belshazzar is a made-up name. Well, then the archaeologists did more digging and more digging. And as they did more digging, more and more tablets emerged. I'm going to show you a picture of one of those in the second service. And in these tablets, records of the Babylonians' kings came to light. And a story emerged where after Nebuchadnezzar died, there were kings who had several short reigns. A man by the name of Evil Merodach, don't call your son that, Nergal-Sharezer, and finally Labashi-Marduk. And most of them were terrible kings, and in the case of Labashi-Marduk, he was so bad, an inner court coup removed him and put in King Nabonidus. And that's who people said there, Nabonidus was the last king of Babylon. Well, here's the thing. Nabonidus spent so much time away from Babylon, he actually moved his capital away from Babylon. He spent so much time away from Babylon that in the year 553 BC, he appointed his son, or his adopted son, to be his co-regent, the king on the throne with him. And what was his son's name? Well, in the tablets, there it came, Belshazzar the Mashari, Belshazzar the prince. And so once again, the critics were stymied. Who was in charge of Babylon on the night that it was destroyed? Belshazzar. Historical records show that Nabonidus was not in the city. He had been captured. He had gone north to defend a city called Sippar. He had been defeated. He had been sent into exile. Who was in the city? Who was the king in the city on this night? Belshazzar, the prince. I love the words of a liberal scholar. His name was R.H. Pfeiffer of Harvard University. He was one of the men who believed Daniel was written in the 2nd century B.C. And I don't usually love these words. He says, "We shall presumably never know how our author learned that Belshazzar was functioning as king when Cyrus took Babylon." You know, how did he know that? Well, it's pretty easy if you believe that the author was an eyewitness, someone who was there at the time, living in the 5th century B.C. in Babylon itself. So this happens on the last night of Babylonian rule. This kingdom of the Medo-Persians were ascending to world power, growing stronger and stronger. And for several years, they'd been chipping away at the Babylonian kingdom, really like ants eating in towards the center. And now it had come to the point where King Cyrus of Persia had surrounded Babylon and he'd begun a siege. And the siege was now on for several months. So on October 12th, 539 BC, these events take place. And so with the Persians surrounding the army, shields, spears, the clank of soldiers, horses, tents set up all around the city, what was King Belshazzar doing? Was he manning the battlements, setting up oil to pour down on the soldiers, giving every able-bodied man a sword, a shield, a bow? Was he calling for food rations? Those are the typical things you do when an enemy surrounds your city. What was he doing? Belshazzar did none of those things. According to verse 1, Belshazzar held what? A feast. And not an intimate family and friends feast. A lavish, extravagant orgy for how many people? 1,000. This was a huge party. With wives, nobles, concubines arriving to drink and get drunk, to lose themselves in merriment and debauchery. This was going to be a hall filled with the shrieks of laughing women, the roaring of inebriated men, the lusty songs of people drinking and celebrating their drunkenness. Musicians would have been playing on their harps and their pipes and their cymbals while dancing girls entertained the hungry eyes of the men. All the nobles and the wives dressed in their finery, decked out in their jewelry, the smell of their fragrances and their spices pungent in the air. Had you been there, the smell of wine would have been overpowering as they poured it in such generosity that it spilled over onto the tables and the floors. Meat being torn off the bone, sweet and sticky, desserts brought out, fruit half eaten, thrown down. And sexual atrocities that are simply unspeakable. A full-out orgy, party, debauchery. Now, why this scene when the Persian armies are around your city? Was this a kind of last wish before we die kind of crowd? Was this a let's eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we literally die? No. Belshazzar held this feast to shake his fist in the face of the Persians, to make the point he was so unconcerned about them, they could have a party. You see, you might remember, as we mentioned last week when we looked at Nebuchadnezzar, just how remarkable Babylon was. Do you remember how high those walls were? When excavated, the walls were discovered to have been 113 meters high. That's the height of a 37-story building. 28 meters thick. 28 meters, that's bigger than this room. This is not the kind of wall you tunnel through. When you're about to attack a city with walls 37 stories high and 28 meters thick, you're like a flea taking a knock at the titanium door of a bank vault. See, Babylon was widely regarded as completely unconquerable. The walls were preposterously big. No siege engine, no machines, nothing invented till that point could have broken them down and allowed an army in. The Persians were not going to get in through the walls. And the Babylonians knew that. Not only were the Persians not going to get in, the Babylonians weren't going to be starved out. The river Euphrates ran right through the city, no problem with water. And historians, Herodotus, tells us that they had food provisions laid up for years. Years of food. And so, by the time of this siege, October 12th, by the time of this night, the armies of Persia have actually been around the city for between 2 to 4 months. And so you know what this is? This party is nothing more than a taunt. It's an insult, an arrogant mockery of the Persians. It's an act of defiance. You are so weak, our walls are so strong, that we'll hold a feast while you sit out there. You're not going to get in, we're not going to be starved out. But Belshazzar's pride went beyond arrogance, it went a step further into defiance. Look at the defiant act. The defiant act in verse 2. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God, which had been in Jerusalem. And the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. What's happening here? Well, this is a step further. Belshazzar drinks, and in the original, the words, while he tasted the wine, suggest while he came under the influence of the wine. He's starting to get drunk. And one of the effects of alcohol on many people is to make them feel very bold, confident, courageous. Ever met a drunk person willing to ask you things he'd never otherwise ask you? Right? And so he's willing to step over lines he probably might not otherwise have. And so he does a very bold and brash thing. You remember from chapter 1 that when Nebuchadnezzar conquered Jerusalem, he plundered the temple. According to the custom of ancient warfare, you would go into a city, you would go into the temple of the god of that city, take its furniture out, take it back to your god's temple, and put the furniture in there. So you did two things. You said, number one, my god is stronger than your god because he just let me beat you. And number two, you took out some insurance for yourself. You took those items, you didn't desecrate them, you carefully put them in your temple so as to say, yes, little God, you have a place in my God's temple too. I'll take care of you. That's what Nebuchadnezzar had done. But what did Belshazzar do? Well, Belshazzar is not going to do that. He's not going to do what a good polytheist does who takes care of every possible god. Because, you know, if you're a polytheist and you believe there's many gods, you don't want to offend any of them. You want to make sure they're all happy. But Belshazzar's not going to do that. He goes to get the objects that belong to the God of Israel and he's going to desecrate them. What do we mean? He's going to use these objects which were set apart for worship in the middle of his perverted orgy where unspeakable acts are taking place. He's going to have all the temple prostitutes, all the immoral men and women, increase their drunkenness and increase their debauchery using God's vessels. You see what he's saying? Not only is Jehovah a conquered God, we'll use his cups and jars for our sinful pleasure. We're going to get dirty and wipe our feet on God. Not only that, but while we drink out of Jehovah's cups, that God who claims to be the only God, we'll praise our gods. So much for you being the only God. Haha, Marduk, Bel, Nebo, we praise them. So we'll take the stuff of the God who claims to be the only God, we'll profane those vessels and use it for idolatry. You have to ask yourself a question here. Why did Belshazzar select the vessels from God's temple? Why did he select Jehovah's vessels as the vessels to desecrate? I mean, remember, Babylon has over 53 temples to all kinds of gods throughout the city. They had conquered numerous countries. And you can imagine just how many objects of all these different gods were in the city. Literally hundreds. Why choose Yahweh? Why choose Jehovah? Was it just the God that came to his mind? Was it just purely random? No. I think that Belshazzar knew full well that to desecrate the items of Jehovah was the boldest, brashest act he could muster. See, Babylon had already seen the power of Israel's God, hadn't they? They'd seen it with Daniel. They'd seen it with Daniel's interpretations. They'd seen it with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They'd seen it when Nebuchadnezzar sent out a proclamation to the whole kingdom to say, Israel's God is the true God. He's the most high God. They knew it. They already knew Israel's God was the God of gods, the Lord of lords. And so when Belshazzar did this, he did it with knowledge. A strange phenomenon that people who reject God nevertheless reflexively have to admit that he's there in their acts of profaning him. It's rather like the phenomenon today of people who claim to be atheists or agnostics, but when they curse or swear, whose name do they use? Does it strike you as odd that they don't, when they stub their toe, they don't say Hare Krishna? Or when they bump their head, they don't say good Allah? Why is it that the proper names that they use for swearing and cursing are the titles of the Christian God? God, Lord, Jesus Christ. I think that's curious. It's as if when people want to make a point, they select the name of the God they think is the most likely candidate to be the true God. Why curse with a name that means nothing to you? Why swear by a name you claim has no reality? It makes no sense. Like Belshazzar, man has knowledge of God intuitively and he sins against that knowledge. Romans 1:21, because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, but became unthankful and were futile in their thoughts. Defiance. But the party came to a shattering halt. Look at the chilling sign. The chilling sign, verses 5 and 6. In the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his hips were loosened, and his knees knocked against each other. I can tell you that Daniel wrote that with a smile, I'm almost sure. The king and his party see fingers writing on the wall. Whether they saw a whole hand, whether they saw just fingers, whether they saw it holding an instrument, whether the fingers were larger than normal, a massive hand, or just a hand literally the same size as a human hand, we don't know. Regardless, they see a disembodied hand writing on the wall, and it turned squeals of laughter into screeches of terror. The music stops, the party freezes, and the king goes from beating his chest to jelly legs. A fascinating little archaeological note. A man by the name of Robert Caldewey was excavating the ruins of Babylon from 1899 to 1917. And he discovered a room that was almost certainly this room. It was the throne room. 56 meters by 18 meters. A massive room, easily able to accommodate over 1,000 people. Three entrances, a place where the king's throne would have been. And here's what's fascinating. Guess what the walls were made of? Plaster. The same plaster preserved thousands of years later for us to see. Someone interrupted the party and has done so in the kind of way that the party can't go on. And so the king calls for the same people who had done so well interpreting the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar. Look at the hopeless experts. The hopeless experts. Verse 7 and 8. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. The king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck, and he shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Now all the king's wise men came, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. You know, with a track record like these guys had, it's amazing. They kept their heads, let alone their jobs. These guys have a batting average of zero. Here, the resident experts in the spiritual, the esoteric, the supernatural, they come in, they promise the moon. To be clothed in purple is a sign of royalty, gold chain. To be the third ruler in the kingdom is interesting. It's further proof of the book of Daniel, because Nabonidus was still king number one, Belshazzar was king number two. Third ruler would be the one who'd rule with them, he'd form a triumvirate. Now, why you would want to be the third ruler of a kingdom that presently consists of just one city full of drunks under siege, I'm not sure. But they took the bait and they tried. They couldn't read it, they couldn't interpret it. We don't know why. Maybe they couldn't make out the script. Maybe they could and just didn't know what to make of it. Whatever the reason, they remained the consistent failures they had been in the past. And Belshazzar is about losing his mind. At this point, we see the queen's suggestion. The queen's suggestion. Look at verse 9. Then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled. His countenance was changed and his lords were astonished. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall. The queen spoke, saying, "O king, live forever." That wasn't going to happen. But do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy God. And in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans and soothsayers. Inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar, now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation. So this emotional mood in the party is going from bad to worse. And as Belshazzar is beginning to just break down, in walks the queen. This probably isn't his wife, because she would have been there in the party. It's probably the queen mother. Not only because she only enters at this point, but because she speaks to the king in a kind of way that a normal queen wouldn't. There's kind of a mother's authority here. So more than likely, she's the queen mother, perhaps Nabonidus' wife, Nitocris, or maybe even Nebuchadnezzar's widow, Amytis. At any rate, she uses words that sound exactly like who? Nebuchadnezzar. There's a man called Daniel who had the spirit of the holy God within him. It sounds like she saw the signs, she saw the miracles, she saw the dreams interpreted, and she knows this is a perfect fit. See, somewhere between the reign of Nebuchadnezzar and his successors, Daniel had apparently been demoted, bumped aside, relegated. As new administrations came in, put their own people, their own friends, their own relatives in the key positions. But Daniel's always been there, he's still around. And bear in mind, this is 65 years after Daniel and his friends were taken to Babylon. Daniel is probably in his 80s right now. But they know where to find him. However long it took, an hour or so as Belshazzar fretted and paced, Daniel's found, Daniel's brought in. The prophet is commissioned. The prophet's commissioned in verse 13. Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? I've heard of you, that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me that they should read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not give the interpretation of the king. And I've heard of you, that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Whether or not Belshazzar didn't remember Daniel, whether he was trying to make up for his demotion or neglect of Daniel, we don't know. He tries to flatter him. He tells him the situation, gives him the same hollow offer of being the third ruler in the kingdom. And now I want you to pay attention as you hear the words of this 80-year-old man speak somewhat condescendingly to this young king in his reply. Look at the king's indictment, verse 17. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, a kingdom and majesty, glory and honor. Because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne and they took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen. And his body was wet with the dew of heaven till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses." Straight out of chapter 4, right? "But you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew this, and you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze and iron, wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know. And the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified." Wow. Can you imagine his voice ringing out in that throne room as all these princes and wives hear Daniel indict the king? This is a man of God. Daniel says, "Keep your reward." He knows better. He knows the Persians are coming in tonight, and the last thing you want is to be third ruler in the kingdom. Paint a big target on your back, shall we? He doesn't want to be identified with Belshazzar, and he's not interested in prizes. He says, "I'm going to make the interpretation known because I'm going to announce what God says." And he does so by rehearsing some history. And when he's finished rehearsing all that we saw in chapter 4, he indicts Belshazzar on three counts. Look what he says to him. He indicts him in three ways. Number one, he says to him in verse 22, "But you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this. You committed willful pride." You knew it. Belshazzar knew the history of Nebuchadnezzar. He didn't humble himself. And you have to ask yourself, how many today know the history of those who've lived arrogantly, but they don't learn the lesson? How many have grown up with Bible knowledge? How many have known what God did to Israel? How many know of the crucifixion of Jesus, his resurrection? They know the story behind it, but they don't learn the lesson. To whom much is given, what? Much will be required. Greater knowledge is greater responsibility, greater indictment. Not only did he commit willful pride, look out what he did. He defied God himself. He defied God himself. He says in verse number 23, "And you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven." He goes on to describe what they've done. "You did more than being proud in your own person. You tried to insult God directly." You know, the writer of Hebrews gives us a new covenant version of this. He says, "Those who know about Christ and his death for sin, but ignore it and go on, are guilty of this kind of thing." Hebrews 10:29 says, "Of how much worse punishment do you suppose will he be thought worthy who has trampled the Son of God underfoot, counted the blood of the covenant wherewith he was sanctified a common thing, and insulted the Spirit of grace?" It is no small thing to know the gospel and reject it. And thirdly, he says to Belshazzar, "You have worshipped false gods." He says in verse 23, "You've praised the gods of silver and gold and bronze, and look at the end, which do not see or hear or know. And the God who holds your breath in His hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified." Idolatry is a twofold slap in the face of God. One, it says, "I will not thank the God who keeps me breathing and puts food on my table and lets me live every day." And number two, "I will praise and honor things." Things. Created things. Food, money, a job, a car, a house, a reputation, a lifestyle, hobbies, power, prestige, pleasure, relationships. It's all the same thing. I will give what belongs to God to these things. Willful pride, defiance, and idolatry. This is the charge sheet against Belshazzar, and it could be the charge sheet of many a person today. And Daniel then goes on to describe the Lord's judgment. The Lord's judgment. Verse 24. He says, "Then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, and this handwriting was written." And this is the inscription that was written. "Mene, mene, tekel, ufarsin." This is the interpretation of each word. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, you've been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Daniel, unlike these losers, has absolutely no problem with the writing. Mene means numbered. God has counted up Belshazzar's days. They're at the end. They've counted down from whatever down to zero. Tekel means he's been found too light on the scales, as if Belshazzar has been put there and God's standard has been put on the other side and Belshazzar has just dropped. He's too light to continue. And Perez, which is the same as Ufarsin, Ufarsin, the U is just an and, the sin is a plural, it's the same word. The word actually means divided, but it's a play on the word for Persia. Babylon is about to fall and its kingdom be divided to the Persians. So here's Daniel, the faithful prophet, announcing God's doom on this king. It leads to the prophet's reward. Verse 29, "Then Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom." Yeah, an odd man, Belshazzar. You know, after hearing the worst news of his life, he seems to happily pump Daniel's hand and, you know, reward him. I'm sure Daniel didn't wear those things for long. I'm sure as soon as he got out the room, he took them off. And then we see the prophecy fulfilled. Look in verse 30. "That very night, Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, was slain. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old." So, well, how did that happen? With those 37-story walls. How in the world did they get in? Well, King Cyrus of Persia laid siege to Babylon. And after about a month or two of more or less just hanging around outside the walls, the Babylonians became less vigilant, stopped watching, realized these guys are just never going to get in. We may as well live life as we used to, have a party. Once that had happened, Cyrus sent a team of his engineers upstream to further up the Euphrates River. And his engineers diverted the river so that a large part of it moved into a basin. He stationed his troops at the gate where the river entered Babylon and the gate where the river exited Babylon. And as the river was diverted, its level dropped. It dropped to the level of just about thigh height. And as the level dropped, it was easy for the men then to crawl under, get into the city. As the Persian army entered, they took over with virtually without a fight. Hardly anyone was watching. Before they knew it, the Persians were upon them, took over the city. We know one man they killed that night, Belshazzar. Proud, defiant, idolatrous Belshazzar. Does this mean that everybody who shakes their fist in the hand of God is going to get a sudden judgment? No, we know many people from Scripture and from life who continue to do that. Just this week I saw the writing and the work of a particular death metal band who've called themselves and made their goal to be the most blasphemous act in the world. They're still going on. See, the lesson here is not when God judges. The lesson is in the inevitability of judgment. The same God who numbered Belshazzar's days has numbered ours. He selected the day of your birth, and he selected the day of your death. And he too will weigh you on a scale. On the one side of the scale will not be other people. God's not going to compare you with most people to see were you a generally good person in comparison to most other people. No, on the other side of the scale will be his Son, Jesus Christ. And only if you are as righteous as Jesus Christ will you enter into his blessedness. If you go down, if you are at all less righteous than Christ, a judgment awaits which Christ called eternal torment. How can you ever be as righteous as Christ? By turning away from your own works, your own efforts, your own sin, and embracing Christ as your only hope. He says, whoever comes to me, I will never cast out. If you come to him in faith and say, please will you forgive me for my sins, give me your righteousness, give me your robes for mine. The Bible promises he'll do just that. He will forgive you. His righteousness will be credited to you. Your sin credited to him on the cross. For everyone who believes they can live in God's world by God's permission and enjoy God's gifts, but never know and love God, the handwriting's on the wall. Such pride and defiance will eventually be judged. But everyone who, like Nebuchadnezzar, humbles his heart, turns to trust in the living God through Jesus Christ, will find the welcoming arms of a father. Let's pray.